Morning.
Good morning, counsel.
May it please the court. I am Charles Patrizia of the law firm of Paul Hastings, appearing on behalf of the appellant Gregory English. The issue before the court this morning is whether the court below erred in dismissing the Section 1983 claim brought by Mr. English against the Department of Mental Health, and also erred in dismissing the supplemental jurisdiction claims that were brought by Mr. English. The answer from my side, obviously, is that the court below did err. The issue here in 2020 hindsight is that the Department of Mental Health now postulates a process that it now says would be sufficient. But that is not the process that it offered to Mr. English. It is not the process that it was pointing to in the court below as sufficient. And the process that was offered to Mr. English was not at all meaningful in time.
Counsel, just let me ask you a question. Put aside the process for a moment, which of course we'll get to. Is it fair to say that you would agree that the government has a legal right to the $2,100?
I would not agree with that, Judge Silberman, and for several reasons. The first one is that it's been denied in the pleadings that statute necessarily applies to Mr. English, who was confined to St. Elizabeth's as a result of a finding that he was not guilty by reason of insanity. So he is not there voluntarily. He is not there as a result of a conviction. He is there because he was found not guilty. Second, there is a substantial question as to the way in which...
Why does the guilt or innocence have anything to do with the right of the hospital to have the money to offset the cost?
Because the second point, Judge Silberman, is that he is entitled to Medicaid. He had been on Medicaid for the entire
period of
time.
That has nothing to do with guilt or innocence. I don't know. Why is that relevant at all?
I agree it has nothing to do with guilt or innocence.
Well, why are you even mentioning it then?
I'm making the point, Judge Silberman, that his confinement was not the result of a voluntary
decision. Yeah, but so what? That has nothing to do with the hospital's right to the money, does it?
It has a substantial issue as to whether or not the government can compel someone who has not been found guilty and who is not voluntarily there to pay for his care.
I don't recall that argument even presented in the briefs at any point. Is it there?
I don't think it was an issue that came up in the
You're making it now new in the Court of Appeals?
I'm not making that point as a new argument. I'm trying to respond to Your Honor's question. I think the point is that even if the government is entitled to seek reimbursement, he had Medicaid, and his Medicaid lapsed as a result of something that D.C. failed to do. So
again, what does that have to do with the price of tea? That wasn't in the case.
It did not come up in the court below. That is true, Your Honor. The court below agreed, we all agreed, that he had a property interest in the funds.
But it also was conceded that there was no need for pre-deprivation hearing.
I agree with that.
So post-deprivation is adequate, if it was adequate procedure.
If there was an adequate procedure, a post-deprivation proceeding would be sufficient. I agree.
Why isn't the contested hearing that is provided for in the regulations adequate procedure?
I want to be clear as to which, quote, contested proceeding Your Honor is referring to. The grievance proceeding.
I'm talking about the one that is referred to as the contested proceeding. There's another word in it, but it is contested proceeding. I think after the whoever the administrator makes a decision, there is a provision in the regulations for a contested hearing. And indeed, the D.C. Court of Appeals said on appeal on this case it was premature because your client hadn't gone through the contested hearing.
There would be two answers to that, Judge Silberman. The first answer is that such a contested proceeding, had it properly been noticed and offered to Mr. English, might well be sufficient.
He was represented by counsel at the time. There was no question that they could look up and see there was a provision for a contested hearing.
But what's interesting about that, Judge Silberman, is that is not the position that the Department of Mental Health took in the court below. The Department of Mental Health took the position in the court below that the grievance proceeding was by itself sufficient.
Right.
It never referred to the OAH proceeding. Brought it up.
They referred to both. But
I'm sorry, sir, they did not.
Okay, but would you concede the contested hearing is adequate procedure?
I concede that a contested proceeding would be an adequate procedure had it been offered to him and he had been given notice of it. He was not.
Well, wait a minute. He had counsel. That proceeding existed. Counsel could have invoked it at any time.
The court below relied on the fact that there was a process available to the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, and indeed the Department of Mental Health, I would say to the court, waived the argument that it now makes here that that OAH proceeding was sufficient because it never made that argument below.
Counsel, when one comes into court asserting that there's a federal due process claim, you are necessarily, and the Supreme Court has made the point over and over again, you necessarily are making a systemic argument, not an as applied argument. You have to say the process available is inadequate as a matter of law for this reason or that reason. You can't come into court and say, you know, there was an error made in the procedure. That's a local law question. That isn't a due process issue. You with me on that?
The Supreme Court
has said that over and over and over again.
I agree with the court that
so
that
you have a contested procedure here, and it is available to your client. It is adequate procedure under anybody's theory. Why isn't that the end of the case?
Because as a matter of fact, and in this case, that procedure was not made available to Mr. English.
It is available. It's in the regulations. Counsel could look it up and say, gee, let's go to a contested procedure. Beyond that, the Court of Appeals said you have this court of the contested procedure when they remanded it and said the case is premature. So the Court of Appeals gave you notice of that.
Only after all of the proceedings occurred here. Again, Judge Silberman, the problem here is that the Department of Mental Health never referenced this proceeding, which it now claims is sufficient. It never took the position in the court below that that was.
They didn't say that in the district court below?
They did not.
They said the grievance procedure at which there was a hearing was adequate.
That is exactly the point, Judge Edwards. Indeed, if one goes back and looks at the briefing by the Department of Mental Health and the argument in front of the court below, they specifically refer repeatedly to what they call a seven-step process, which is the grievance process and an appeal from that process to the D.C. Court of Appeals. If there were an OAH hearing available, it was required by D.C.'s own regulations that notice be given to Mr. English of that, and it never was.
Yeah, but that's...
Is that grievance procedure that you're talking about now, is that the one at which the city failed to provide the policy?
Yes, sir. It is a process in which, frankly, I can only use the term a mockery. Mr. English was not given the opportunity to subpoena witnesses. Indeed, he asked for his social worker to be present. She was not.
Does their regulation say they will not provide the policy, or was that simply a failing in this particular proceeding?
They rely.
I don't know how you have a fair hearing under any notion of process if you can't get the policy in dispute. That seemed pretty absurd to me.
That's what I'm trying to understand.
Did D.C. say this is it? He's got his grievance procedure. There's nothing more that's due. You're saying the argument that the point that Judge Silberman is raising was never at issue with the district court.
That is correct, Judge Edwards. And more importantly, as to the policy, the policy has putatively been drafted since 1987. It was not made available to the independent hearing officer in the grievance proceeding. He asked for it repeatedly. It was not made available.
So no one got it.
We asked for it under the Freedom of Information Act. And we were told it's in draft, you can't have it. But it was the policy that was relied upon by the Department of Mental Health, both in the grievance proceeding and in the court below, but no one has seen it.
Strange process.
It is a strange process. But if I can return to the point that Judge Silberman was making, again, before the court below, the Department of Mental Health repeatedly argued that what they call the seven-step process, which runs from the notice that they were going to bill him through the post-deprivation grievance process to the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia, was the sufficient process. There was never a reference to the OAH hearing process. That occurs only post hoc, Judge Silberman. It is entirely a post hoc creation.
But it's clear the contested hearing clearly is available. The Court of
Appeals,
it's not, when you say it's post hoc, the D.C. Court of Appeals pointed to it.
The D.C. Court of Appeals pointed to it, although I would add to the court that at the time that the action was filed in the district court, there wasn't even a decision from the grievance process.
That's true, but you got it shortly thereafter.
We got it shortly after the filing, only because the filing alerted the Department of Mental Health that it had lost. The grievance process. And the D.C. Code provides, Judge, if I may add.
Let me just ask this question.
Yes, sir.
Would you concede this point that, accept your proposition, which I don't frankly think is true, but let's accept arguendo, that there's a particular problem that the D.C. did not point to this contested procedure, that it was only in the regulations. Would you concede that a contested procedure would be adequate process?
A proper contested proceeding at which the appellant could have subpoenaed witnesses, could have had all of the process available, would clearly be sufficient.
Well, a contested procedure does give you all that right.
It does give you those rights if it were made available to him,
What do you mean if it made available? The regulations and the statute make it available.
The Department of Mental Health never relied on that process.
No, put that aside. Put that question aside, whether or not they if it does exist and it is adequate procedure. Is that not correct?
It does exist. It would have been an adequate procedure.
Referred to in the regulations?
The only regulation provides that there is a right to a fair hearing. There is no regulation in the Department of Mental Health that refers to the OAH process.
I didn't think so. The regs don't refer to the OAH. The regs say he's supposed to be given notice of whatever procedures he has available. Is that right?
They do. And, in fact, the Department of Mental Health is part of the Department of Human Services. Their regulations specifically provide that there must be verbal and written notice of all of the mechanisms available. He was never given that notice.
So the potential problem that Judge Silverman is raising is it is available by reference to statute and he had counsel. So that you're saying the regs don't point to it. They never relied on it.
They never thought it was the process that they were supposed to use. They didn't rely on it in the court below. If the court is familiar with Animal House, it's like double secret probation. There is simply no mechanism by which Mr. English should have been aware of that process.
But why? I don't understand why counsel couldn't be available. I thought it would be rather easy to find it if I was counsel. I don't understand why your counsel couldn't find it.
Well, I would point to the fact that the Department of Mental Health's counsel didn't find it either, Judge.
Put aside that question. I mean, this is, in a sense, this is, as I repeat, when you go to federal court, you're claiming there's a systemic problem, a run-of-the-mind problem, as the Supreme Court has said over and over again, not an error in procedure.
And there is a systemic issue if the Department of Mental Health...
What is the systemic issue if the process that we both described would be adequate if it was used? How can there be a systemic issue?
The systemic issue is that the Department of Mental Health didn't think that it needed to use that process.
Let's assume they were dumb. Let's assume the Department of Mental Health was dumb. But why were the lawyers representing English not adequate?
I suppose because the lawyers representing English through the grievance process took the position that if there were another process available, it would have been given notice. And at that point, they didn't even have an answer out of the grievance process.
You don't have to be given, no party has to be given notice of a procedure that legally exists. There's no case ever held that a process that is in the regulations or statute has to be given, a person has to be given notice of that. That's the law.
Well, I understand that, Judge, but on the other hand, it is also the case that the court has repeatedly held that one does not need to exhaust all available remedies before
that's a separate issue. That's a separate exhaustion of remedies is a separate issue. Because in a federal court, you're challenging systemic problems, not an individual problem. I thought your case mixed up individual concerns with a systemic concern.
I think it tries to make the point that both exist.
You did discuss this in your reply brief, and you didn't make the argument that the government didn't rely on it, which you're making here. You said, as noted above, there is no regulation or guidance regarding how to request additional review. Well, that's not true. Mr. English provided no instruction on how to render the DMH final decision. But you don't even make the argument that the government waived this point. So you waived the waiver.
I don't agree that I waived the waiver.
Well, you didn't make the argument you're making here.
Specifically,
your whole argument today, you weren't the lawyer representing down below. It was younger lawyers in your firm, right?
I will take the responsibility for the presentation below, Judge.
No, I understand. But the arguments you're making here today are not the arguments they made below, even in the district court.
Because the district court had a different process in front of it. The DMH didn't raise the OAH issue at all. It wasn't even in the record before the court.
No, yes, it was. It was in the record. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to find it.
I disagree with the court, but I understand the court's position. Yeah. I'm out of time, and I have run over.
I just want to ask one more thing. Do you mean to concede that if there is an alleged process available for someone, and no other process, just this alleged process, and the person comes into it and they're told, well, we're not going to let you be heard, we're not going to give you anything, whatever, that can't be a due process violation unless you can show it's systemic?
I want to be sure that I understand your question, Judge Edwards. I would not concede that the bare existence statutorily of some process which is never referred to, which is never referenced, which is
process,
never relied upon, isn't a systemic
process.
Issue.
I want to make sure I understand what you were conceding to in reference to Judge Silverman's systemic principle. That if there's an alleged process which, if done properly, might be okay, but you're brought into it and intentionally denied things within the process that would make it the fair process that it purports to be, that can't be a due process violation?
I agree with Your Honor. That is exactly a systemic issue. If I was inadequate in my explanation to Judge Silverman, I apologize. But that is
a systemic issue. It doesn't have to repeat itself in the next case. It could be done correctly.
That's and
well, I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing, because the way I'm hearing you answer Judge Silverman, you seem to be suggesting it had to be a repeat, systemic, ongoing. That is not my understanding of due process law.
I would not say that at all, Judge Edwards.
You can have the failure in the one case. For example, in this case, I would have thought part of your argument was, what kind of process is that? They wouldn't give them the policy that was in dispute. Forget whether or not the availability of the OAH is somehow dispositive. I thought your argument to us was, this can't satisfy due process if you can't get the policy at issue. What kind of hearing is that?
Well, I agree. I think there are two points to make. One is that the process that was made available to Mr. English was a mockery.
And it can violate due process whether or not the same thing occurs in the next proceeding.
That is correct. My only point to Judge Silverman was that now that the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia has ruled, hopefully the Department of Mental Health will now give the notice and do other things. This situation may not recur, but it was a systemic violation at the time.
Just to make sure that I understand your argument, Mr. English did have some process. He challenged the invoice, and he also had this grievance procedure, this external review. So is your argument that because you felt the grievance process did not provide him enough, that was not adequate? Or are you saying that there always has to be this contested hearing?
Well, as the court knows, the standard under Parrott v. Taylor is that the touchstone is that there must be a meaningful opportunity at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner.
I understand what I'm trying to.
There was no meaningful opportunity.
Is if, in your view, the grievance procedure had been carried out as it should have been, and he was able, in other words, that they had been responsive to the external reviewer, would that have been sufficient? Or are you saying something even more than that is always required?
I think there are two answers to that, Judge Brown. The first one is that certainly would have gone a long way. It apparently is the perspective of the D.C. Court of Appeals that even that process, had it been more fulsome, would not have been sufficient to lead to an appeal to the D.C. Court of Appeals. And therefore, at least in the D.C. Court of Appeals view, you must always go through the contested proceeding in order to have the right to appeal to the D.C. Court of Appeals.
That's exhaustion.
I would agree with the court that's probably the right rubric. Yes, I think that's probably right.
What I'm trying to get at is what process is due? And are you saying that it's, you know, that's not enough, even if it were properly done and even if they were completely responsible?
I think it cannot be enough because, as Judge Edwards has said, in order to get court review of that underlying final determination, you must have gone through the contested proceeding before OAH, at least in the D.C. Court of Appeals view. Thank you. I have reserved 2 minutes, and I will take those. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stacey Anderson on behalf of the District Appellees. Your Honors, we'd ask that the court affirm the dismissal of Mr. English's complaint, particularly with respect to the due process clause, because he failed to state a plausible claim for relief. The district does have adequate process to address Mr. English's challenge to the taking of his funds from his account.
Which is that?
Well, there's multiple processes, Your Honor. First of all, there was the grievance process with the.
Well, like you just can't possibly, on this record, claim that that was adequate. If you don't give someone the policy that's in dispute, there's no case that I'm aware of that even suggests that that would be okay. That's ludicrous.
I want to be clear that the policy that was in dispute was the underlying policy authorizing the taking.
Yeah.
That goes to the merits of his challenge to the taking, Your Honor, not to the process.
I saw that argument in the brief. That's bogus. If you bring me into a process and you say, okay, Harriet, here's your process, and I say, okay, I want to challenge what happened to me, and I say, oh, well, we're not going to give you anything. We're just going to bring you in the room. You got your process. Come on, that is a procedural matter. If you're unwilling to give me the opportunity to present evidence that I need to present, to see what I need to see, that is procedural.
He had that opportunity, Your Honor.
He didn't have the policy.
But he had the argument that without the policy, the district didn't have the authority to take his funds. He had the opportunity to bring witnesses in and question them.
If you're saying to us the argument you want to advance, if you want to go to OAH, I'll listen. But if you're saying to me, all we need to argue is a grievance procedure, in my mind, it's the fastest loss that I've ever seen in the Court of Appeals.
Then, Your Honor,
because there's no process that he was given. If you're not going to give him the policy, that's in dispute.
I think you're saying, counsel, there is a line that's fuzzy between what is substance and procedure. Mm-hmm. And if the Mr. English had full procedure, and at the end of the procedure, the government said, well, you've got all the process you want, but we think we have a legal right to do this without stating any policy.
Correct.
Then that would be a substantive question, not a procedural issue.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that is the district's point with respect to that.
That's what the hearing officer understood, too?
No, I'm just using a hypothetical.
Yeah, right. Well, let's go back to the real case and away from the hypothetical.
Your Honor, and had they wanted to challenge that grievance process, they could have gone to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they did have notice. At the very least, they had notice from the D.C. Court of Appeals that that was an available remedy. It was also stated in the regulations they could request.
Is this the argument that you made before the district court that the OAH was available?
Your Honor, I will concede. We did say they could go directly to the Court of Appeals, and that was a mistake.
Right.
But I am relying on the fact that the Court of Appeals, when they attempted to go there, directed them in the correct place.
To
the contested hearing, which they did not pursue. They did not pursue that contested hearing. But even putting aside the grievance process and the contested case hearing before OAH, there were other available remedies. There was another way to get to the D.C. Court of Appeals in this case. They could have gone directly from the taking to the Superior Court with an equitable action.
But that's a more complicated question as to whether or not part of due process involves the question of what's available in the state courts. That gets complicated. You don't have to rely on that. You have a contested hearing in which counsel could have subpoenaed everybody, could have got the whole nine yards, could have cross-examined everybody.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Certainly.
Now, for the life of my, why haven't you relied on that?
Well, have you? I have in this court, certainly. And again, yeah. I've conceded there was a mistake below in not arguing that.
But your point, of course, is that once the Court of Appeals called attention to it, there was no question. Mr. English could now go to the contested hearing. Isn't that correct?
That's my question. Is that correct? Time limits?
There are time limits.
Yeah.
Now.
Of course there
is. And I would have said, had he attempted to file that within 30 days of the D.C. Court of Appeals decision, that he would have an argument that he was lulled by the district into not filing there in the first instance. But there's nothing that's lulled him since the D.C. Court of Appeals issues its decision.
The D.C. Court of Appeals decision pretty much indicated he could go immediately to the contested hearing as a matter of D.C. law.
Correct.
There's no question he had a right then.
Right then he had it, and he has sat on that right, Your Honor. So there may be an issue because he's sat on that right.
Yes, okay.
In terms of the time.
But certainly he had it right after the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Absolutely. I certainly think.
And you would argue that the D.C. Court of Appeals has a fairly reliable view of what D.C. law is.
I would say so, Your Honor. They are the final authority on
I would think so.
So that was certainly an available procedure to him. And there's no challenge here to the adequacy of that proceeding. In fact, I think there's been a concession here that had he pursued that, it would have provided him the process that he was due in this particular case. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, that would again be, we'd ask that the court affirm based on the fact that there was an available adequate procedure to redress the taking in this case.
Mr. Patrizia, I know you were out of time, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, and I don't necessarily need the entire 2 minutes, one has to recall the timing of the determinations in this case. We brought a proceeding both in the district court and before the D.C. Court of Appeals to challenge the result in the grievance process, which, by the way, had not even been finished at the time we brought that action. Under D.C. code, the Department of Mental Health was required to stay all activities in the grievance proceeding once an action was filed in any court of law. It simply ignored that and proceeded to issue a final decision once the case was filed. Second, the D.C. Court of Appeals did not rule until after, months after, the district court had acted and this appeal had been filed. And DMH is now claiming, as I understand the argument before the court, that the D.C. Court of Appeals decision is by itself sufficient notice to require Mr. English to return to the administrative process, even though all of these other proceedings were in place. And the D.C. Code says that all proceedings are stayed as long as there is a pending action in court. So I don't agree that if there were a time limit, we don't have the right to go back. But again, as Judge Edwards said initially, the problem here is the systemic one of the way in which the Department of Mental Health approaches.
That's not systemic. That's applied, as applied. You're mixing systemic and as applied.
Well, I don't
again, I reiterate, I may be in disagreement with my colleague, but the Supreme Court says over and over again that in a due process analysis, the question is not whether there was a procedural error in this case. It's a question of whether the procedure, as in the run-of-the-mind cases, is adequate.
And to take that point, Your Honor, if the Department of Mental Health, up until the time that the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled in the other proceeding in this case, that there had to be a contested proceeding, that was systemic. That was the Department of Mental Health's view. It had that view repeatedly.
Wait, which view? I'm sorry?
It had the view that the grievance proceeding was by itself the sufficient fair.
It might have been. That may have been. I don't think you have to reach that issue because you have the contested hearing, which is the full nine yards. It's absolutely everything, and it's set forth in both the statute and the regulations.
Do you doubt that you could, that your client could have gone to the OIH procedure right after the D.C. Court of Appeals?
I don't think at that point that under the D.C. Code it was available because all proceedings in relation to the grievance were stayed. Under the D.C. Code.
Notwithstanding what the D.C. Court of Appeals said?
As I understood the D.C. Court of Appeals, Your Honor, what it said is there was no
D.C. Court of Appeals said you could go to the contested hearing now.
I don't think it said so in so many words, Judge. I think what it said is we have no jurisdiction because there had not been a contested proceeding. It gave the statutory reference to the contested proceeding full stop. I do not believe that it said you should return now to the contested proceeding. Moreover, the D.C. Code provision says that all such proceedings are stayed as long as there is an action pending in court. This appeal was already pending.
We'll look at that.
Unless there are further questions, I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Case will be submitted. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Larry Roth for Hill Dermaceuticals. I'm going to go out on a limb here and try to do my initial argument in 4 minutes. The main point, and I want to reserve and do not concede anything that we don't get to and would rely upon what we have in the initial brief and the reply brief. The two issues I want to focus on is the scalp oil and the ear oil. This is a case involving three generics to Hill's reference listed drugs on the scalp oil. In the citizen's petition and in Dr. Woodcock's memorandum, which the citizen's petition was based on, said that the scalp is different from the rest of the body. Hill's scalp oil is specially made, and to get absorbability, percutaneous absorption to the scalp, because the hair is different, although not much of mine is, but different from the rest of the body. And she said if there's a difference in formulation or a difference in ratio, then the agency has to look at the generic product very carefully to make sure.
What are you referring to now?
The scalp oil.
She is who?
Dr. Woodcock, Janet Woodcock. They overruled the generic division, and who said that all you have to have is just plus or minus 5% difference in variations in the products. There's no question on this record that the Hill products are different than the generics. The generics do not have two
little fragrances.
Well, they're not so little, Your Honor, in the sense of that they have a purpose, and not just for odor, but they're also terpenes, which go to the issue of absorption. But even if you say they're nothing, for the scalp, Dr. Woodcock ruled, and the citizen petition says this, that the hair on the head is different from the rest of the body hair, except for certain areas like the underarms, and beard, and pubic hair. In those situations, you have terminus hair. It's thick and it's coarse. And if you have a different formulation or a different ratio, and the generics have to have...
Counsel, perhaps you just should focus on what you think is an error here.
That they did not do a careful review, as Dr. Woodcock said, and then she went on to say if there's a difference in formulation, there can be an effect upon the absorption, the ability of the active ingredient.
That is not the position of the department.
Yes, it is.
Isn't your argument that in order that they made a mistake in finding bioequivalence?
Well, it is a bioequivalence argument. Under 320.22B3III, you have to meet all those, and it's in conjunctive, you have to meet all of them. Basically, what I'm saying down to the core is that the generic scalp was not bioequivalent to the Hill product because they did not do a careful review, because they had different ingredients, as Dr. Woodcock said that you had to do, because they had no way of knowing because of the difference between the scalp.
Counsel, you're making a jury argument here. I don't understand the legal argument.
The legal argument is that they did not properly find, they're arbitrary and capricious, did not properly find that there was bioequivalency under the regulation, which is 21.320.22B3.
Because of what? Woodcock is a subordinate official there, is that what you're saying?
She is the head of CEDAR. She's the one.
She's not the decision maker here?
She is the decision maker.
So you say she made an error or not?
No, the Office of Generic Drugs made
an error. Which is the office above her, I guess.
No, she's above everything.
Well, now I'm really confused. Are you saying that the department agreed with
they
you?
She made a policy statement.
Wait a minute, the department agreed with you? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying the department, through the citizen's petition response and Dr. Woodcock, made...
The citizen's petition was back in 2004, right?
2009, March 25th.
Oh.
And she...
That's not the decision that's being reviewed.
What the decision being reviewed is the one from the district court that denied the permanent injunction.
Right, and that in turn reviewed a decision of the department whereby they approve the new drug.
Well, there's three drugs.
I know the three drugs. Okay, the approval of those three drugs is what's on appeal.
Yes, and okay. I'm talking only about one. They're all different drugs.
Yes, and I understand. There's the scalp, there's the skin, and there's the ear.
Right.
All right, but I'm trying to understand what Mrs. Woodcock's role is in this and why you're focusing.
She made the agency's policy statement that if you have a generic drug.
This is in response to the citizen's petition?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's not the ruling
but
that's on appeal.
But they violated.
Wait a minute, that's not the ruling on appeal, is it?
Yes.
No, the ruling on appeal is the approval of the new drug.
And that's because they did not follow the policy of the agencies. The agency's policy, which said that you have to have a careful review when you have a generic that's trying to imitate the reference listed drug if you don't have the same exact ingredients with regard to the scalp, because the scalp is unique. Scalp psoriasis is a unique disease that is affected by differences in formulations and ratios, and the RLD drug and the generic drug have different formulations. That's what I'm saying, and they made no careful review. All they did was they treated the same, all three drugs the same. They said the body oil drug and the scalp oil generic drug is the same. The only differences they have from Hill's products is that there is plus or minus 5% difference because of the absence of the fragrance. No determination of whether or not it would have an effect upon absorption into the scalp here, which the agency as a scientific policy said was different than the rest of the body, different from the ear, different from the hair on your body. And they didn't do that. All they did was they said it's plus or minus 5% difference in variations, therefore it's the same drug. I'm saying that that was an arbitrary and capricious decision. It violated and did not follow the scientific decision and policy set forth by Dr. Woodcock. And because of that, they had no clue whether or not it would affect the scalp in any way and whether or not it ever even reached the scalp and be effective.
Counsel, I have a procedural question.
Yes,
why,
sir.
Why did you come into district court seeking an injunction? Isn't it a fact which you have an Administrative Procedures Act claim, do you not? And the appropriate, even if you were to establish that the FDA had committed an error, the proper response is remand to the agency to correct the error. I don't understand why you're seeking an injunction, why you sought an injunction. That's inappropriate.
It started out as a citizen's petition and
No. The citizen's petition, and it was before the
they approved
the informal adjudication that you're appealing.
Yes, Your Honor. In October 17, 2011, they approved three generics.
I understand. As a matter of administrative law, the appropriate process is to come to federal court challenging the agency action. If you prevail, it is remanded back to the agency for proceedings not inconsistent with a legal decision of a court. There's no appropriate, there's not an appropriate situation for an injunction here.
Every case.
I'm going to ask the civil division why they even indulged it. I couldn't figure it out.
Every case there is, Your Honor, that I reviewed, when a generic is approved, you go to the district court and you ask for a preliminary injunction and or permanent injunction, wherever the case may be. There's no procedure to go back to the agency, and because that's a quasi-final decision.
You are seeking review under the APA, right?
But it's a quasi-proceeding, yes, and you review the record, and this court on appeal can review that record de novo. Everyone agrees to that. But there was no procedure, there's no course under 21 CFR section 10 to go back to
You have a right under the APA. When the agency approves the three drugs, that wasn't informal adjudication. You have a right to come to district court because there's no provision to the Court of Appeals. The district court then sits as an appellate court reviewing agency action. It's not appropriate to seek an injunction at that point.
It is appropriate because you're trying to, enjoining the granting and asking for vacation and suspension of those granting of the ANDAs. There's no other procedure that was ever brought up in this case by anybody other than the procedure that we followed.
Under the citizen petition.
Well, the citizen petition became part of this case, right, because it has all the issues upon which this generic used as a roadmap, supposedly, to get their approvals.
Right.
That's why the citizen's petition is important to this case, to all three drugs.
The citizen petition was filed before the new drug application came in.
Yes, sir.
Obviously in anticipation of what was coming down the pike.
It set forth because...
Isn't that right? You were anticipating what was coming down the pike, so that's why...
At some point in time, sure.
Yeah.
And, in fact, there was three there at the time. And we filed the citizen petition because Hill wanted to change the way that topical corticosteroids were being reviewed. All other dermatology products, you have to do clinical tests, except for corticosteroid products, where all you do is a vasoconstrictor test, which where you rub the arm and you see what the reaction is in terms of the constriction of the blood vessels. Here, and Hill, and the citizen petition was partially granted to Hill's position on the scalp. They granted what Hill said had to, that the generic had to do on the scalp. So what it was the framework by which the generic drugs then applied less than about 2 weeks after the final decision was rendered March 25, 2009. On April 14, 2009, the generic filed their first ANDA on one of Hill's products based upon what the agency ruled in the citizen's petition. So that's how the citizen's petition becomes enveloped into this whole procedure. And that was the policy. That was a policy statement, the scientific statement that the agency made on all the issues that are involved in this case. And the major point is, several major points, they didn't follow. They didn't follow on the scalp oil. They used the wrong regulations on the ear, on the eardrops, the ear oil. And finally, on the solution, they made no scientific determination. The solution is an overarching thing. What these three generics did not want to do under any circumstances is to do any type of test. And what we're saying is that they were not eligible for, on this record, for the self-evident bio waiver that they got, which is the free pass, you know, pass go, get you $200, that they got because of the violation of the policy on the scalp oil, the agency's decision on the scalp, on what you have to do to get an equivalent generic. Secondly, on the ear oil, they used regulations that were plainly, erroneously interpreted that don't apply to the ear oil situation, and they used a bio waiver, a provision 320.24b6 that says you have that's in the context of all testing, and they did absolutely no testing whatsoever. All the government did, all the generic division did, that is, and the generic division I'm not sure ever met a ANDA they didn't like, but all they did was to say, oh, the only differences between these drugs, the Hill brand drug and the generic drugs, is the absence of two fragrances, which they concluded without anything else, just statements. We conclude that didn't make a difference because it was in 5% difference. So if you don't have two ingredients of a drug, you have to make it up. You have to make up that 100% someplace else. So that's why the formulation changes, the ratio changes, and that's why it's so important to the scalp. And on the solution issue, that's an overarching one, but we can win on the scalp and the ear products without the solution at all. And if we win on the solution issue, then that's overarching, because the solution is, it either is or it isn't. They didn't do a scientific review of the solution decision. They did an administrative review. And on all those grounds, we submit that these three drugs were improperly approved. And this court can look at that record, the administrative record, de novo, and make the legal decisions or legal conclusions from that, even if it's different from the same conclusions that the district court looked at. So you look at it afresh if we put cases in there. Okay? I said I was going on the limb on 4 minutes. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Cindy Cho and I represent the FDA and other federal appellees. Like counsel for Hill, I will focus my argument on one issue, whether FDA's determination that the generic drugs were bioequivalent to Hill's drugs was arbitrary and capricious.
Let me ask you a couple of preliminary questions. Are you aware of our rules that strongly urge parties not to use acronyms that are not normally known by lawyers?
Yes.
And?
I will endeavor not to use any acronyms during this argument.
No, I'm talking about your brief, counsel.
Yes.
Were you aware of the rule at the time you wrote the brief?
I believe I had reviewed the rules, and I apologize for any deviation from them.
I suppose you can get by with NDA and ANDA. They become pretty common. But you have a number of acronyms which are really quite labored, and it's almost impossible to read the brief without running back and forth to glossary. You can use one word. Read Supreme Court opinions. They avoid acronyms like the plague. I don't know why this has become such a problem with young lawyers, but we have tried to suggest, please don't do it. And we would think the civil division would read our rules. That's the first question. Now, the second question is, why the devil don't you come into federal district court and say, wait a minute, the request for an injunction is inappropriate. This is a review of agency action.
The reason we didn't do that is because my understanding of Hill's lawsuit was that they were challenging the agency's approval of a generic.
Of course,
drug.
That's an informal adjudication. The district judge is sitting, in effect, as an appellate judge, and that he's reviewing agency action.
Yes, and that agency action was final. As a result, we don't oppose lawsuits that...
No, you're not opposing the lawsuit. The question is whether it's appropriate to seek an injunction. It isn't. We've said that in opinions a few times. It's an extraordinary situation where a court would issue an injunction in reviewing agency action. If you find an error, you could identify the error, remand it back to the agency, because the agency might take a different path to come out to the same position, which might be legal. You're with me as a matter of administrative law, aren't you?
Yes, the appropriate remedy would be a remand to the agency.
Then why didn't you tell the district judge an injunction is inappropriate?
Well, in conjunction with that, would you remind me, in these cases, is it not accurate that parties do come in to block the approval pending further review? Isn't that what's happening?
Yes, what happened here was...
This isn't an unusual request, is it?
That's right. It's not unusual.
Yes, I recognize it, but I do think this pattern may have developed, but it's inconsistent with administrative law, isn't it?
They're trying to block the generic from getting on the board, right?
That is what appears to be the case.
As opposed to some of the other administrators, I mean, maybe I'm trying to figure out why this happens. They don't want the generic out on the market.
Yes.
And they're trying, and so, fine, you may send it back, but meanwhile, you're asking the district court, it's the only place that has authority, stop them. Don't let them let this approval be final and let that generic on the market until you've looked at it and hopefully send it back and make them review it. Is that right?
That's the idea. Yes. Going on to the bioequivalence issue, a generic drug maker is entitled to a waiver of not bioequivalence itself, but the clinical evidence submission requirement to establish bioequivalence. In order to receive that waiver, the generic drug maker must meet the following three criteria. First, that the drug is a solution for application to the skin. Second, that it contains the same active ingredients in the same concentration and dosage form. And third, that it contain no inactive ingredient or difference in formulation that would significantly affect the absorption of the drug. Only the first and the third criteria are at issue here. And starting with the first, whether the generic drugs are solutions, the record fully supports the agency's determination that they were. The generic drug maker, of course, submitted an abbreviated new drug application in which they described their own product in a way that comported with the United States Pharmacopeial Convention definition of solution. FDA noted that and placed that reason in its review. In addition, the generic drug makers' development reports describe the process by which they formulated their drugs. That process also goes towards the drugs being solutions. An active ingredient is dissolved in isopropanol, the solvent, and then placed in oils where it remains.
What about on oral argument? He has focused only on one issue, hasn't he? The scalp, largely. And he hasn't made the solution argument here. He said if he wins on that, he wins across the board. But that isn't what he's relying on here. What about the specific arguments he's making here, which I gather relies on the Woodcock view?
First of all, the decision to approve a generic drug is not any one individual within the FDA's decision. It's the agency's decision. And addressing the scalp oil issue itself, that discussion in the FDA citizen petition response was based on the situation that if the generic drug does not establish bioequivalence through a waiver, then you go on to a discussion of how do they do that. And that's where Dr. Woodcock weighed in with how a generic drug maker would establish bioequivalence if they didn't meet the waiver requirements.
So you're saying if my aunt had wheels, she'd be a trolley car, because in this case, there was a waiver of the bioequivalence.
Yes, so that's right.
So his argument is irrelevant.
That's correct. And so the real question is whether the waiver was proper.
Right.
And I would argue that, yes, it was proper. It was a solution. And going to the last criteria issue that I mentioned, the inactive ingredients or the deletion of the two fragrances. That deletion is plainly acceptable under the bio-waiver regulation, as well as a separate regulation that governs the whole abbreviated new drug application process. It allows for those types of changes as long as they don't affect safety or efficacy. And the record shows that once again, FDA carefully considered whether the deletion would affect safety, efficacy, or as I mentioned earlier, absorption. You can see that in the abbreviated new drug application, the generic drug maker explained that they deleted these fragrances because they could cause irritation to patients with sensitivities. The fragrances themselves are in very low concentrations and they don't contribute to the pharmacology of the drug. FDA reviewed and evaluated that application. They put on the record the reasons why they found it persuasive. They also confirmed that the fragrances were a tiny part of the total volume of the product. They consulted within different divisions. They determined that another guidance also applied here that allows for exactly these kinds of differences. In its briefs, Hill also argues that the volume differences in other inactive ingredients renders the agency's grant of bio-waiver faulty. And in fact, the only record evidence that supports Hill's argument that these slight changes in the volume of the other inactive ingredients could have any effect is one affidavit. And that affidavit was submitted by Hill in support of its citizen petition. In the affidavit, their purported expert makes the conclusory statement that a slight change in product formulation could affect the drug itself. FDA specifically considered that affidavit and rejected it in the citizen petition response, stating that the generic product need not be exactly the same as a reference-listed drug, and instead referred to its regulations and said that any changes in inactive ingredients were permissible if they did not affect safety or efficacy. And in fact, the differences in volume of the inactive ingredients between the generic drug and Hill's drugs is very small, and smaller than the differences in Hill's own batch-to-batch productions. The bottom line here is that the record shows FDA's careful consideration of the deletion of the two fragrances. As a result, the grant of a bio waiver for the body and scalp oil was not arbitrary and capricious. Unless the court has any further questions, I would submit that the evidence in the record fully supports FDA's decision here to approve the generic drugs. And for all these reasons, along with those contained in the government's brief, this court should affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you failed to do your argument in 4 minutes or even 10, but we'll give you 1 minute.
With regard to the solution, there wasn't one scientific test, and we don't in any way waive this, wasn't one scientific test done to establish that the Hill products are solutions. In fact, they cannot be solutions. And the agency had said that. They said they are immiscible liquids. There's to be a solution, everything, molecules all have to be bound up. In the Hill product, it's not. The active ingredient is put into alcohol and then oil.
Question whether the ANDA is a solution.
If they are a solution, Hill's products is not a solution, and there's not sameness under 355J. There have to be the same drugs unless they petition, which they didn't petition here. I urge if you want to send this back and set new precedent to the FDA, we will gladly participate in that process because we did not participate in the first process.
It's an informal adjudication.
Secondly,
you're very gracious in suggesting you'd like to participate.
I would ask that you grant the permit injunction on the two drugs, even on the solution in our briefs. I think we have more than enough. If not, send it back and let once and for all the science determine whether or not it's a solution or not, and we'll go back to the district court on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is William Chang of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, here on behalf of petitioner Daisy Construction Company, which represented itself pro se in the proceedings below. Your honors, we're here today because the ALJ affirmed a willful violation of the trenching regulations, not based on the record as a whole as required by American Wrecking and Dayton Tire, but based on select portions that inaccurately portray Daisy as an employer that intentionally disregards the safety trenching rules. The ALJ did not adequately consider, in fact, sometimes entirely ignored, evidence inconsistent with that picture, including evidence of Daisy's good faith efforts to comply with those rules. Moreover, several of the ALJ's central findings.
The ALJ is correct concerning his finding relating to Del Señor. Isn't that the end of the case?
It is not, Your Honor. Well, it depends.
What I mean is, Del Señor is a senior fellow. The ALJ finds that he is present during the trenching, that he sees people in the trench, and that he does not do anything about it.
Yes, Your Honor, that finding was central to the ALJ's willfulness classification, and that finding highlights why that classification cannot stand under American Wrecking and Dayton Tire because the ALJ overlooked contrary evidence. That finding that Del Señor ordered workers to enter a non-compliant trench can only stand and only depends on Mr. Drake's testimony that the digging began at 8 a.m. But Mr. Cannon, who is a third-party witness who was there the whole time, who the ALJ actually relied on, had testified the digging started at 9:30. Del Señor, according to the ALJ, was there around 9:30 to 9:50. So if Cannon were to be believed, then Del Señor did not order workers, even assuming that he did not order workers into a non-compliant trench. At the very least, under American Wrecking and Dayton Tire, the ALJ was required. He must adequately consider anything that fairly detracts from the weight of the evidence as he sees it. That didn't happen here. Lead to the second point. The ALJ also relied on testimony that Del Señor came back and forth into approximately three hours from that time, about 10:30 to 1:15. And based on that, the ALJ again concludes that Del Señor must have known that at some point workers were in a non-compliant trench. It did nothing. Again, that's speculation not based on evidence, which caused this court in Dayton Tire to vacate the willful classification. If the secretary wanted
it's based on evidence.
I think it's based on speculation for this reason, Your Honor. It was the Secretary's burden to prove willful. We don't have any evidence. First of all, it's disputed whether he did go back there, but let's just assume that he was going back and forth during that time. There's no evidence of when he went back there. Drake actually testified, I can't be sure what time, I just know he did. Mr. Cannon, who was there the whole time, after repeated question from the Secretary, said, I can't be certain he went back. But even assuming he did drive back and forth, there's no evidence of when, how deep the trench was, if he did come back to that particular excavation site, and what he could see from whatever angle he was standing on. It was the Secretary's burden to show that, and she did not, and therefore the ALJ incorrectly relied on speculation, not evidence, that it was noncompliant.
Where did you raise good faith below?
In the PDR, we did challenge the willful citation. We didn't use the words good faith.
You didn't raise good faith below.
You
either raised it or you didn't. You didn't, right?
I would disagree with that.
Well, you're now trying to infer something in a way that you're attacking the other side for inferring something, huh?
No.
Good faith was not presented as a precise theory below, right?
We didn't use those exact words. I agree with that, Your Honor, but this is why I don't think that matters for a waiver issue. First, Daisy was represented pro se.
Pro se, what good is that? This is a corporation. This is not a defendant in a criminal case. You're not telling me that a corporation can get away with waiving down below and then hire Morgan Lewis and Bacchius to come in the Court of Appeals and say, well, my client isn't responsible because the client was pro se.
Your Honor, that's not the only thing I'm saying.
I think that's the worst thing you're saying.
And it was the first thing you said, too.
Yeah. I suppose if you were representing General Motors, you would take the position, well, General Motors was pro se down below.
I said that in conjunction with the fact that that Daisy did not use the words good faith. I want to follow up on what the rest of that thought. Willfulness, as this court has said in American Wrecking, willfulness cannot exist if there's good faith. In Falcon, which the Secretary cited in the briefs, explains again, the concepts are two sides of the same coin. So by challenging willfulness, necessarily good faith is part of that whole argument. So even though we didn't use the words, we did argue the concept, and we did argue that Daisy took steps to comply with the trenching regulations.
Without fighting over the various evidentiary and testimonial questions, would you concede if the ALJ properly or legitimately held or found that Del Señor was present when people were in the trench and the trench didn't have the box, that that's enough to satisfy the case?
I disagree, Your Honor, because his finding was that Del Señor ordered people into a non-compliant trench.
Yes, my question is, if his finding is sustained on appeal, is that the end of your case?
That he had them enter a non-compliant trench, I do, not necessarily, Your Honor, because there's also evidence of other good faith efforts by Daisy that needed to be weighed, but that was not weighed.
Well, you have a problem there, because even the various cases indicate that it doesn't matter what the background of the company is. If the senior person is watching while there's a violation, that's enough to make it willful.
Your Honor, I disagree. And I would
disagree with which?
The idea that it's the end of the case if a supervisory misconduct is imputable to the corporation.
More than a supervisor. Del Señor is fairly senior, isn't he?
He's the operations manager, but that day he was filling in Dathan Booth, who was the superintendent for that project.
So he's doing both?
Yes.
Yes.
So he's even bigger.
But, Your Honors, the case law is clear, including the cases that the Secretary cites. Even willful misconduct by a supervisor is only imputable to the employer. It satisfies the Secretary's initial burden, or prima facie case, which then could be defeated. The willful classification can then be defeated by evidence of the employer's good faith efforts to comply with the trenching rules. And I wanted to address the three other evidence that the ALJ did not consider, the most critical pieces. First, it's undisputed that Mr. Maruca, the project manager, went there that morning and told Foreman Drake that a trench box was needed and it should be used. Undisputed.
He had something else to say that morning too, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And I was going to get to my second point. Instead of addressing that testimony, the ALJ relies on testimony on the very same page where apparently, allegedly, he said, get this done before the state inspector comes back. We don't know what that means, but...
It means that you better move pretty quickly.
It could be taken to mean that with... But you have to address the evidence that comes before and right after that testimony. Before Dre testifies.
Counsel,
no undue pressure.
You're making an argument that an ALJ has to consider every bit of evidence in the whole case. I don't recall any court of appeals ever holding that.
Your Honor,
you're right. The whole record is on review. But you can't challenge an ALJ by saying he must have specifically in hoc verba referred to every bit of evidence in the case.
Then that is not Daisy's argument. Our argument is that the ALJ must adequately consider anything that fairly detracts from the weight of the evidence.
Well, he thought Del Señor wasn't telling the truth. He did say that, didn't he?
He did, but he didn't address that. Yes, Your Honor.
Comes pretty close to the end of the case.
But not with respect to willfulness, because his willfulness discussion, ALJ's willfulness discussion, relies heavily on the fact that he believed Del Señor ordered workers into a non-compliant trench. You don't need to believe what Del Señor said to find error of that finding. All we have to do is look at Mike Cannon's testimony, which the ALJ had credited throughout the other portions of...
You mean with respect to the time?
Yes.
But he's the only one who says 9:30. Everybody else says 8 o'clock.
Well, that's not true. Only Mr. Drake says 8 o'clock.
Well, Drake is the key witness. He was there.
So was Mike Cannon. It was testified. He was there watching the thing the whole time.
Well, that's sort of puzzling. One person says the digging starts at 8 o'clock, and the other person says, what does he say Cannon says about
9:30.
He says it started at 9:30?
The digging started at 9:30. He says he arrived at 8:30. The digging started later. When the secretary asked when did it start, he said about 9:30.
So there's a discrepancy.
There's a discrepancy.
So the ALJ has to believe one or the other, right?
Yes, he at least has to address contrary evidence. And here, this isn't just any piece of evidence, as your Honor is saying.
He said he believes Drake.
Well, he didn't even address Mike Cannon's testimony. And keep in mind that the ALJ actually credited Mike Cannon's testimony
on another
in other places. Yes. And in Dayton Tire, I think one of the problems this court found with the proceedings below is that the ALJ had credited one portion of a witness's testimony, but not another portion without explaining it. Here it's even worse. The ALJ doesn't even address that other portion that's contrary to a key finding. I just want to address two more points before I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You don't have
that was cute. At least you smiled when you said it.
Well, I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Louise Betts for the Secretary of Labor. May it please the Court. The only issues properly before the Court today are whether Daisy has proven the affirmative defense of unpreventable employee misconduct, and whether the violations Daisy admits committing were properly classified as willful.
I suggest you address the latter point first, because that's the point that counsel relied on most heavily.
Certainly. I apologize. I've got
you can reach down and get a drink at any point without being teased on television for doing it.
With respect to the willful classification, under well-established case law, two supervisors' conscious disregard of OSHA's trenching requirements constitutes their willful violations of the requirements, particularly in this case, given their heightened awareness of OSHA's trenching standards. Those supervisors' willful violations are properly imputed to the employer.
But what focus on counsel's argument? His fundamental argument is the ALJ did not consider Cannon's testimony that the digging started at 9:30.
Certainly, Your Honor. The ALJ did note in footnote 12 of the decision that Foreman Drake's testimony was largely consistent with the testimony of Mike Cannon. The ALJ also determined that, as Your Honor mentioned, Mr. Drake's testimony was particularly credible. In this case, there was clearly some discrepancy about the exact timing of the digging. These were employees giving estimates of when they thought things happened in the morning. It doesn't really matter here when precisely the digging took place. We have two employees who testified, and both employees were found by the ALJ to be credible, that Mr. Del Signore observed workers in the trench when it was non-compliant. Mr. Drake testified to that point on multiple occasions. He testified that while the trench was non-compliant, Mr. Del Signore was back and forth to the work site observing workers inside the trench. Although he said he couldn't say what precise times he was there, he never recanted his testimony that at various points during the three-hour period he was there observing workers in the non-compliant trench.
And who was the other employee?
Mr. Cannon, not a DAISY employee, but an employee right. of another employer, testified that when Mr. Del Signore observed the workers in the trench, there should have been a trench box in place because of the trench's depth. The ALJ properly relied on that testimony in concluding that Mr. Del Signore observed workers in a non-compliant trench. And I do agree with Your Honor that that is the end of the case here if this court sustains that determination by the ALJ. Good faith doesn't help the employer here for two reasons. First, because it was plainly waived. DAISY seems to suggest that the ALJ should have sua sponte determined whether DAISY was entitled to a good faith defense, even though DAISY didn't raise it at the ALJ level. Not only did DAISY not raise it to the ALJ, but DAISY didn't point that out as an ALJ error in its petition for discretionary review to the commission. Under 29 U.S. Code Section 660, they've waived the argument, and this court can't consider it. Even if the good faith argument, which is a defense, was properly in front of the court, DAISY has failed to prove that good faith should excuse its willful violations here. The doctrine of good faith essentially requires the employer to show that it took the same steps it needed to take to establish the unpreventable employee misconduct defense, that it had a safety program that was adequate to prevent the kind of willful violations by its supervisors that took place here. The only case DAISY cites for the proposition that something else is required to prove good faith was a reversed decision by the commission. The commission subsequently made clear in its Reynolds decision that essentially the factors that prove unpreventable employee misconduct are the same factors that an employer would need to show to prove good faith. All of the cases here establish that to show good faith, DAISY would have needed to show that it had an adequate safety policy, that it communicated the policy to its employees, that it enforced violations of its rules when employees committed them, and that it disciplined its employees for committing violations. If I could turn to the unpreventable employee misconduct defense, none of those elements were met here. It's a four-pronged defense, and I should say the first element of having a work rule the government does not contest, but this is a four-pronged defense. The other three elements are not met here. DAISY failed to adequately communicate its work rules to its employees. This requires DAISY to train not only its supervisory employees, but its non-supervisory employees as well, as the Fifth Circuit explained in the Floyd S. Pike case, so that non-supervisory employees are in a position to object to instructions by their supervisors to engage in unsafe conduct. And very tellingly here, the employee in the trench exposed to the unsafe condition here, Michael Moore, was barely trained at all by DAISY. He allegedly received only one toolbox talk in trenching safety. We don't know how long it was or what specific content it included. And we have testimony by the compliance officer that it was probably just a 5 to 10 minute talk. Typically, that's what a toolbox talk is. He testified that he had no other training but only received on-the-job experience. Again, under well-established commission case law, on-the-job experience is not enough. An employer can't simply assume that because employees have experience that they're well-trained. Moreover, the record reflects that DAISY provided no training whatsoever to Bill King, the excavator operator on site, who also clearly needed to be educated in trenching safety. Accordingly, because this element of the unpreventable employee misconduct defense is clearly not met, the defense fails here. The third element, Daisy also failed to make a diligent effort to discover violations. When asked for evidence of its efforts in discovery, it produced only 2 inspections of its project over a 3-year history. It produced a blank trenching inspection checklist, but didn't produce any checklists that were filled out. Although it should have received completing trenching safety checklists from its foreman on a weekly basis, it didn't have any completed trench lists to present, and its own operations director, Mr. Del Signore, had never seen it before. Because DAISY failed to take diligent efforts to uncover violations, this is another reason that its unpreventable employee misconduct defense fails. The testimony by its superintendent that he made rounds to the work sites to look for violations doesn't overcome the lack of documentary evidence here. As the First Circuit held in Joyoso 1 and 2, where employers, supervisors testify that they've done inspections, but the employer can't document them. An administrative law judge is entitled to rely on the lack of documentary evidence as evidence that the inspections didn't take place and were inadequate to satisfy the employer's burden of proof. Finally, on unpreventable employee misconduct, DAISY failed to enforce the violations. Quite briefly, they had no discipline policy. They had never disciplined any employees before, despite evidence in this record that its employees had committed multiple safety violations, including trenching violations, on past occasions.
Let me ask you about the burden here.
Yes, Your Honor, I was just going to turn to that.
Okay. Because there seems to be an argument that, you know, whether this is an affirmative defense and a claim that under Third Circuit precedent, which is where this occurred, the violation occurred, as I understand it, that the burden would be on the Secretary.
Yes, Your Honor. The burden is not on the Secretary here for at least 2 reasons. First, because DAISY waived its burden of proof argument. In its petition for discretionary review, not only did DAISY fail to object to the burden of proof or to raise burden of proof as an issue on page 4 of DAISY's petition for discretionary review, it in fact characterizes unpreventable employee misconduct as a defense. Even if the issue weren't waived, it's not on point in this case for 2 reasons. First, only some courts have held that the Secretary should ever have the burden of proving unpreventable employee misconduct. This is not one of those courts. Although the Third Circuit has adopted this doctrine, the Secretary disagrees with it. The courts that have adopted the doctrine have held that where the only inference of employer knowledge is a supervisor's knowledge of his own misconduct, for the Secretary to meet her prima facie burden of proving knowledge, she has to show that the supervisor's misconduct was unforeseeable. In this case, because DAISY hasn't challenged the knowledge element of the Secretary's prima facie case, even if this court were to adopt that line of supervisory misconduct cases, such as been adopted in Pennsylvania Power and Light and the other cases cited by DAISY in its brief, it wouldn't affect the outcome here. Finally, even if it were on point, even if it affected the outcome, even if this court wanted to adopt that doctrine, it shouldn't affect the outcome of the decision here because the ALJ correctly held that whoever has the burden of proof, the evidence in this case plainly demonstrates that the 4-prong unpreventable employee misconduct test has not been met. If there are no further questions, the Secretary respectfully requests this court to deny the petition for review and affirm the final order of the commission.
Thank you, Ms. Betts.
Thank you.
Mr. Ching, I think you didn't have any time left, but we'll give you 1 minute of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just make a few key points. First, Mr. Drake did not testify that there had been prior non-compliance. The testimony is very clear. He said unprotected, and for the reasons I explained before, that's not sufficient to get the ALJ where he needs to get. The same thing with Cannon. Even though he testified, depths. There's no further testimony. What did he mean by depths? Even the ocean inspectors themselves can't just issue citations by writing depths. They have to actually take measurements to show that it was deeper than 5 feet. With respect to good faith versus unpreventable, the important distinction to note is that they both look at the same actions, but with good faith, it doesn't need to be entirely effective. It doesn't even need to be complete. The Secretary cited cases say that. So even if this court finds that unpreventable employee misconduct does not stand here, there's ample evidence of Daisy's good faith efforts to vacate the willful classification. We ask this court to grant the petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.
You're welcome.